Today I want to sort of wrap up the thoughts of the retreat with a series of selections from the writings of different masters. This is from a letter of Kripal Singh, which is published in Spiritual Elixir. I had been feeling for many months the great hardships that you were facing. It had been my constant worry, and you have always been in my mind. I hope you will now write fully about all that. When the Lord wants to make a great poem of a man's life, he sends him or her to the school of privations, worries, and difficulties, and all the time he keeps extending his protective hand over him or her to pass through unscathed. Teachings of the Masters are for all mankind, all the human beings, the ensouled bodies, and therefore draw no distinction between East and West. Shorn of all rituals and ceremonies, they aim at the liberation of the soul or consciousness in man from the bondage of mind and matter, and it merges in all consciousness. It, therefore, requires a little adjustment in one's way of life and circumstances in the routine of human life. With internal development in due time, outer vacillations do not deflect one in his or her inner flight to one's true eternal home. It is a happy thing to note that you have a dominant desire to better the world in which you live, and that you worry about the human race and let your salvation take care of itself through good works and clean living. It is a very noble idea, but the practical way of effectively carrying it out is to first grow into a beautiful flower yourself, and then to emit fragrance and sweetness to all as a matter of course. You cannot clean the road completely of all the thorns, thistles, and bitter things that lay across it, but surely you can put on strong boots to save your feet from all harm. The ethical and clean life is most essential, but without some degree of inner conviction, one would generally run the risk of a lapse under some severe stress and strenuous strain. This conviction and growth in fullness of bloom is necessary, and the Master, through his sheer grace and kindness, helps to obtain it. Your welfare is as dear to me as a loving father has for his child. I do hope that in the thick and thin of your busy life, you will try to snatch some time daily, and during these periods cut yourself off entirely from the outside world, your environments, your body, and in tune yourself or soul sweetly and lovingly with the celestial light and heavenly music, and develop from day to day so as to attain a conviction necessary to ward off the stormy onslaughts that you encounter in your daily life. In the divine dispensation as well, the law of demand and supply operates as much as in all other spheres of life. If anyone is benefiting by treading the path to God, it is because of the grace of my Master, which is invisibly working and helping him or her up. To be on the way to one's holy home is the highest of all the privileges that a human birth confers, and with the grace of the Master power working overhead, it is possible to achieve it. It is a gift of God through the God-man. And that is from Spiritual Elixir, although, as like all the other excerpts that I will read today, it is printed in The Stranger of Galilee. also. And I want to consider the comment, the part of the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus says, "Ask and it will be given you, search and you will find, knock and the door will be opened for you. For everyone who asks receives, and everyone who searches finds, and for everyone who knocks, the door will be opened." And this is from the Sarbachan. God is within everyone, but nobody knows him. People commit sins while he looks on, but he does not prevent them and makes them go through the wheel of transmigration. What good then is this God to us? But when we meet a Satguru and he explains to us in what form God is present in our hearts, then we are informed and avoid bad deeds and escape the wheel of transmigration. Hence it is necessary to seek a Satguru, for he is the God manifest. And the search for the unmanifested God is not possible without the help of the Satguru. Those who don't do so will neither find God nor escape the wheel of transmigration, but waste this precious human life. And whoever seeks the Satguru will surely find him, for the Satguru is an incarnation eternally present on this earth. And this brings about some thoughts on the connection of different kinds of searching. Often in connection with talking with people, second generation satsangis, people who have brought up on the path, they wonder, well, how am I searching? And there are ways and ways to search. And this particular chapter deals with some of them. This is a famous story from the life of Baba Sawan Singh, taken from the book Call of the Great Master, a section of it, not the whole story. But this is about Sawan Singh. It says, "Once the great master went to Amritsar for satsang. It was his custom to give a satsang there on every Sankrant, the first day of every Hindu month. He was going to the Satsangar on the Majita Road in his car, and the road was very crowded. People were going to the Satsangar in cars, tongas, bicycles, and rickshaws, and a very large number were on foot. He was at a distance of about 2 furlongs from the Satsangar when, at a turn in the road, a man suddenly fell down in front of his car. The driver stopped the car and the great master got down to see what had happened. A drunkard had fallen right in front of the car, but luckily he had escaped quite unhurt. The great master, with the help of a companion of the drunken man, tried to make him stand on his feet, but he was too drunk to walk steadily. A number of satsangis who had gathered around helped him to get out of the way. When the great master left, the drunkard asked who was the sardar in the car, for the great master's majestic figure could not but impress this peasant, even though he was not in his full senses. His companion, who was also half tipsy, told him, perhaps just by way of leg pulling, that the people around said that he was God, who had come to earth to save sinners like him. God he seems to be, and I want to go to him to have my sins forgiven," the peasant said. And after a few minutes, he, with a half-emptied bottle of liquor in his pocket, reached the Satsangar, reclining on the shoulder of his companion. The great master was sitting in an easy chair, relaxing himself. We noticed this man only when suddenly, with unsteady steps, he tumbled down at the feet of the great master, placed his head on his feet, and locked the great master's legs in his arms. "You are God. Forgive me my sins," he begged. No, I am not God, said the great master, trying to release himself from his grip. I am a sinner like you. Now get up, my son. I will not rise unless you say that you have forgiven me, said the peasant. The great master laughed involuntarily, and with the laughter came his forgiveness. Manohar, the master's personal attendant, and Jamadar Partap Singh wanted to remove the man by force, but the great master stopped them from doing so. Well, he said with a smile, this is a strange way of getting forgiveness by force. The drunkard began to weep bitterly. Say what you like, but I won't leave your feet until you forgive me, he said. The great master laughed heartily and put both his hands on the man's head. Well, rise up, for you are forgiven, my son, he said. All my sins? Am I saved from hell fire? Asked the peasant, raising his head. Yes, your faith has saved you, replied the great master. In the evening, the peasant was found standing in the queue waiting for initiation. A few were rejected, but he was among those who were accepted. You will have to abstain from alcoholic drinks and animal foods in the future, the great master warned him. Wine I can never give up. It is simply impossible for me, the man replied. Well, then promise one thing, and that is that you would never take it in my presence, said the great master. That I do promise, sir, said the peasant. How do you earn your livelihood? The great master asked. By theft and robbery, was the surprising reply. Well, that must be given up. You must choose some other profession, said the great master. I don't know any other profession, the man told him. But you must start to earn your living in some other way now that you have been initiated, the great master insisted. I cannot do anything else and have never done anything else, said the peasant. All right, then promise me one thing more, that you will not steal any more than you actually need, and that you will not take anyone else with you when you go out to steal. That I promise with all my heart, the man replied. Before leaving, he again fell at the master's feet. The master again blessed him by putting both of his hands on his head. After this, he committed theft only once. Following his initiation, he went to attend the marriage ceremony of a female relative who lived in Gurdaspur district, and while there, he ran short of money. One night, he entered the house of a Baniya banker and broke open his strongbox. Just as he had taken hold of a bundle of currency notes, the heavy upper lid of the iron chest fell upon his arm, wounding it grievously and holding it fast as in a trap. All his cunning and cleverness failed to release him. When, after a long struggle, he finally gave himself up as lost, the great master appeared before him. Helping the robber to free his arm, he said, "Had you not promised me not to steal any more than you needed? Now run away to save your life and leave everything here." After that, the peasant never again committed any theft. And I comment on this. Gangu, the robber in the story, is a famous person in the Sant Mat tradition in India, and Sanchi has referred to him many times, explaining his background and how he became a robber for reasons not of his own making. And the story about that is extremely interesting, that he was on his way to join the army with some friends, and on the way he came across a policeman who was torturing a suspect. He had the man stretched out on a bed frame with his hands and feet both tied to one corner of the frame, and he was whipping him. Gangu asked him what he was doing, and the policeman said it was none of his business, and told him to go along or he would get the same treatment. And Gangu attacked the policeman, released the bandit, or whoever, the suspect, whatever he was. I don't know if he was guilty of anything or not. and then ran off. And of course, his life was over as far as respectability was concerned. He was now a wanted criminal, having attacked a policeman. And so that is how he eventually ended up at Sawan Singh's feet. The point is that Gangu did not even know he was searching, but he was. Because as soon as he met the master, he recognized him and knew what to ask. Many people who seemed to live far better lives and were more in control of themselves did not know what the master really was. Like Gangu, we may not know we are searching until we suddenly are awakened. When Sanchi was here at Sant Bani Ashram in May 1977, he asked me to do the screening for initiation. A young woman from Martha's Vineyard came, and I asked, "Well, how long have you been on the diet?" She said, 2.5 weeks. I said, "That's not long enough. You have to be on the diet for 3 months before you can be initiated." To which she replied, "Well, whether I can be initiated or not, I don't know. But this is why I'm here. I was walking on the vineyard when a friend stopped the car and said, 'I'm on my way to Boston to see a saint. Do you want to come with me?' I had never thought about this kind of thing, but the idea appealed to me, so I got in the car, got on the ferry, and rode up to the airport." This was the moment when Sanchi was flying in late April 1977. As soon as I saw him, I realized that this was everything I had ever wanted in my whole life. And from that moment, I have not eaten anything that I shouldn't have eaten or done anything I shouldn't have done. But before that, I didn't know. I talked to Sanchi about her, and he approved her application, and she was initiated at that time. So we don't always know we're searching until suddenly we find the master. There are many different ways of coming to his feet. And then I get in talking about man-making and what Master Kripal called man-making. This is a long, it's not the whole letter, but it's a long section of a long letter of Baba Sawan Singh, famous letter, at least it ought to be famous. It's, my opinion, one of the key documents of the path. And as I say, it's a section from that letter. "That which may be a fact to one man may not necessarily be a fact to another, and it will not become a fact to him until he has had a similar experience. Facts of Sant Mat are reproducible, like facts of any science, and can be demonstrated in the laboratory of Sant Mat. The laboratory of Sant Mat, as said before, is inside man. Anybody who enters this laboratory brings his scattered attention within himself at the eye focus, can see, feel, and realize what the saints say, and he can repeat the experiment as often as he likes. Sant Mat deals with facts only, not with theories or beliefs. It lays down a practical course for its devotees. It is practical through and through, and it can be executed by young or old, male or female, wise or simple-minded, while at the same time they are enjoying the fullness of home life. If people would go inside the focus and enter the upper worlds, they would become eternally happy. Empty talk would cease. They would contemplate the grand reality. So first you are to control your mind and rise within yourself to the eye focus, and the other man is to do the same within himself. When inside the eye focus, you and he have both cast off the material coverings, and matter is now no longer a hindrance in your study and upward march. Neither is it a hindrance in your communications with each other, while you are both above the eye focus. To do this, it is not necessary to leave home or country. Anybody who goes inside of his focus is independent of time and space, and he can, from his own experience, give guidance to another who has not reached so far. He who rises still higher and has access to other and higher worlds is capable of guiding others to those higher worlds. As in all branches of study, a student who occasionally meets his teacher and converses freely with him has a distinct advantage over one who takes only a correspondence course. The same is the case here in Santmat and the development on this path. But the beauty of it is that when you gain access to the inner light and the worlds of light within, the elements of time and distance so completely disappear that you stand face to face with your teacher and master, and he will always remain right there to instruct and to lead you as well as to strengthen you. You need not accept anything which does not appeal to you in books or even in my letters. You may leave aside for the time being the ultimate object of life and its how and why. You may start your inquiry from this end and then take as your objective the attack upon the eye focus. Reach that point as best you can, by this or any other method. Draw up your own plans if you wish. Only make and execute some plan to reach that objective. Bring your plan into action. That's the main thing. And then if you find it does not work so well, come back to this plan. The main point is to reach the eye focus somehow. You will be dealing with your own attention. If you succeed in holding it inside of the focus, you have won the battle of life. You say in 8 weeks since your initiation, you have made no progress. Santmat does not fix any time limit. Let us appreciate the situation. Ever since our birth, at which time we left the eye focus and came out of it and established our connections with this world, we have not gone inside of it. Sometimes when we have a deep, intricate problem to solve, we close our eyes and try to think by holding all our attention in the eye center. We do it for a short time, but soon run out again because we have acquired the bad habit of always remaining away from the focus. Poets, painters and musicians receive inspiration from this point. All great thinkers get their ideas clarified here. Whatever scientific progress the world has made has all been derived from this source. This focus, back of the eyes, is the fountain of all inspiration which has produced the world's masterpieces. And whatever further progress is to be made in the future, the source of information and inspiration will still be this point. Here is where divinity comes down to meet the struggling man. And what holds us outside this focus? Why does not everybody in the world rush with his utmost ability to enter this magic fountain of inspiration and wisdom? Because our attention has always been and is yet attached to our bodies, to our near relations, to our homes, to our countries, and to our pleasures, sometimes to our pains and sorrows. We have so much identified ourselves with these things that we have lost our identity. Unless now we start detaching ourselves from these outside connections, begin to develop the capacity to switch our attention on and off at will, we can make but little progress on the path. We are to reestablish our identity, to assert our supremacy over our minds and bodies. Mind must be made to work when we wish it to do so. We must become able to enter this body when we wish, to function in this world when necessary, and then to go out of it at will when we wish to function in another world. It is the attention which is to go inside and see, And so long as it is running outside, who is to see inside? If the owner of a house sits always outside of his house and complains that he cannot see what is going on inside, his complaint is not justified. This detaching the attention from the external connections is a slow affair. Habits become second nature. It takes time to form new habits. But slow and steady wins the race, and practice makes perfect. Follow your mind for a minute and see what keeps it away from its headquarters. Avoid whatever interferes and accept what helps in reaching your objective. I have already given you the saint's method, based on long, long experience. If anyone is sure that he is on the right path, then if he takes but one step a day, he is still approaching his destination and is sure to get there someday, no matter how distant his destination may be. You'll perhaps say, "How am I to know that I am on the right path?" I give you the means of proving it for yourself. Until you have proved it for yourself, you must, per necessity, accept something on faith. You would have to do the same if you were building a bridge. And these are a couple of excerpts from letters of Master Kripal Singh, actually written to me during the mid-60s when I was having a very difficult time. As it says in the book, I was having a terrible time facing up to my own inadequacy and to my own failure as a human being, as a disciple, and as a representative of the Master, which he had appointed me to be. I wrote many letters to Kripal Singh, and he responded with letters full of wisdom, which has remained with me ever since. I have continued to make the same mistakes often, but his letters have helped me to accept my failures. This is from a letter that Master Kripal wrote me on December 2, 1966. He says, "You need not dwell much on your personal character or impurities of mind. It amounts to self-pity. You will please appreciate that by watering the seedling at the roots, the plant thrives most and blooms in abundance. The holy Nam is the tried panacea for ills of the mind. Although it is a very happy augury to be conscious of one's shortcomings, undue apprehension sometimes breeds morbidity, which hampers inner progress. The conscious contacts of divinity within revolutionizes the thought pattern of the child disciple, and he sees everything in much clearer perception. Slow and steady wins the race. Your job is to be implicitly obedient and humbly dedicated. It is for him to reward you for your efforts. Patience is the noblest virtue, but it is the fruit of very long cultivation. Just learn to live in the living present with undivided attention and devotion. You should train your mind in such a manner that when you do anything required of you, there is no hurry, compulsion, or resentment from your side. You will find that it will be helpful to you in all spheres of life, including meditations. My love and blessings are always with you." And this is from the letter of March 10th, 1967. "Worry and hurry are the chief causes to dwell on by the mind. If you could just eliminate these two by resigning to the divine will and pleasure of the gracious Master Power working overhead, you will be relieved of the undue strain and stress. Please note it for certain that whatever comes to your account is in your best spiritual interests, and to become a fit receptacle for the divine grace You have to inculcate a sense of self-abnegation and effacement without involving your mind. The more you are relaxed, reposing, and receptive, the more ineffable bliss and harmony will fall to your lot. Just rise so high in the loving lap of the Master Power to consider yourself as a child who would relish, "Not my will, but thine be done." Your deep gratitude for manifold blessings is good and appreciated. Well, this is another brief excerpt from the Sarbachan, which I have always found helpful. Book 2, paragraph 39. The Lord is always with us all and puts up with our conduct, both good and bad. Whenever he wishes, he will prevent one from misbehaving. Nobody will heed another's advice, then why hurt others? There is no harm, however, in giving advice to those who have faith and confidence in you, and such alone will accept advice. You know, somewhere Master Kripal Singh tells the story of Moses, who sat down to eat with someone who didn't thank God before he ate, who didn't say grace. Moses was offended and was going to do something about it when God said to him, "Oh, Moses, who should be offended, you or I? Who is it that he has not thanked?" Moses said, "You, Lord." And the Lord said, "Well, then, let me take care of it, please. Don't you worry about it." And I make the point at this point that a great many things we do that block our search and prevent us from living according to the golden rule come under the heading of trying to fix it. If we can only do this or that, God will be pleased with us because we have changed things. A great deal of my own life has been spent trying to do something like this one way or another. When I met Sanchi the first time, he rebuked me strongly for having taken it on myself to proclaim that someone else was not a master. His rebuke was painful for me, and according to ordinary political practice, people would have thought I was serving him by doing that. His viewpoint was completely different. "Who wants to be a guru? Tell me that. Is it not better to be a disciple? Why was I dragged into this?" That was what he said to me. It was a complete revolution of my thought pattern, and I was taken aback, although I very quickly understood it. There's another brief section in the Sarbachan concerning people with whom the Master seems to be displeased. "It behooves satsangis to plead for one whom Satguru reproves and to show respect to him whom he honors." In other words, it is not any part of our job to help Master rebuke anybody. We might think, well, he has done something that is really bad, and the Master is going to give it to him. We don't want to displease the Master, so we'll help him out. We'll give it to him too. Whenever I have been tempted to think like that, which, by the way, has been often, this verse from the Sarbachan has stopped me. We are not required to participate in such an action. What is required is that we love, respect, and never judge any human being that comes into our orbit. If we behave in this way, we'll be doing the Master's work. That's a very interesting verse. When I first read it in the Sarbachan, it really struck me many years ago. "It behooves satsangis to plead for one whom Satguru reproves and to show respect to him whom he honors." Apparently, two sides of the same coin. And again, a few more sections from Master Kripal. This is from a chapter in the Way of the Saints called "Blessed Are the Poor in Spirit." And Master Kripal says, "Naturally enough, from love spring forth the ideas of service and sacrifice. Love believes in giving. giving away the best you have and not accepting anything in return, for that would be a barter and not love. Service before self is what love teaches. By love, serve one another, is what the Apostle Paul taught to the Galatians and through them to all mankind. If we look critically, we will soon realize that all service which we seem to be doing to others is not to anybody else, but to the one self-same self, pervading everywhere and in all, including our seemingly individualized self clothed in raiments of flesh and bones. This being the case, there is no ground for claiming any credit whatever. Loving service must therefore flow freely, fully, and naturally as a matter of course, refreshing all hearts, for it will convert the otherwise dreary and desolate earth into a veritable Garden of Eden, for which we so earnestly pray every day, but find it receding from us the more we wish for it. And then I draw a connection between that and selections from Master Kripal's great address at the Third World Religions Conference in 1965. With the yardstick of love, the very essence of God's character with us, let us probe our hearts. Is our life an efflorescence of God's love? Are we ready to serve one another with love? Do we keep our hearts open to the healthy influences coming from outside? Are we patient and tolerant toward those who differ from us? Are our minds coextensive with the creation of God and ready to embrace the totality of his being? Do we bleed inwardly at the sight of the downtrodden and the depressed? And I make the point at this point in the book that the term bleeding heart is used with great contempt and scorn, usually directed at people who are sympathetic and helpful to the poor and needy. It is very clear from Master's point of view that we are supposed to bleed at the sight of the downtrodden and depressed, and that a bleeding heart is not an insult but a very high mark of praise. And Master says, do we pray for the sick and suffering humanity? If we do not do any of these things, we are yet far removed from God and from religion. No matter how loud we may be in our talk, and pious in our platitudes, and pompous in our proclamations, with all our inner craving for peace, we have failed and failed hopelessly to serve the cause of God's peace on earth. Ends and means are interlocked and cannot be separated from each other. We cannot have peace so long as we try to achieve it with warlike means and with the weapons of destruction and extinction. With the germs of hatred in our hearts, racial and color bars rankling within us, thoughts of political domination and economic exploitation surging in our bloodstream, we are working for wrecking the social structure which we have so strenuously built, and not for peace, unless it be peace of the grave, but certainly not for a living peace born of mutual love and respect, trust and concord, that may go to ameliorate mankind and transform this earth into a paradise for which we so fervently pray and preach from pulpits and platforms, and yet as we proceed, it recedes away into the distant horizon. I was going to read a fairly long section from Circular 17, but I think I won't because it's getting late and it's too long. This is again from the Sarbachan Swamiji Maharaj. The Lord himself is present in both, friend and foe. And we should not, therefore, mind either the friendship of friends or the enmity of enemies. The Lord is the mover in both cases, but this cannot be the view of everyone. Only those who have realized the Lord within themselves can take this view. And you who hear the holy discourses should try to imbue yourselves with this idea so that no ill will may enter your minds. This state of mind may not be gained soon, but you will develop it in time if you attend the satsang every day and regularly practice inner spiritual practice. I would like to conclude with here we are. This is not from the Masters, it's from a book I've mentioned here before, Mount Analog, a very great spiritual quest novel, unfinished, but these happen to be the last paragraphs that he wrote. Mount Analog stands for the inner planes, it stands for finding the Master, stands for all kinds of things connected with esoteric knowledge, going within, etc. In the novel, it's pictured as an island in the South Pacific that nobody can find unless they know it's there. And if they know it's there and approximately where it is, they make efforts and eventually they break through and find it because compasses go around it. It's not visible by ordinary eyes and so forth. But then they get through and there it is, and then their job is to climb the mountain. And he described the last, as I say, the novel was unfinished. The writer, whose name was René Daumal, died before he finished the novel. But this is the last two paragraphs that he wrote. By our calculations, thinking of nothing else, by our desires, abandoning every other hope, by our efforts, renouncing all bodily comfort, we gained entry into this new world. So it seemed to us. But we learned later that if we were able to approach Mount Analog, it was because the invisible doors of that invisible country had been opened for us by those who guard them. The cock crowing in the milky dawn thinks his call raises the sun. The child howling in a closed room thinks its cries cause the door to open. But the son and the mother follow courses set by the laws of their own beings. Those who see us, even though we cannot see them, open the door for us, answering our puerile calculations, our unsteady desires, and our awkward efforts with a generous welcome. And really, that's the way of it. And we are never alone in our search. As Sanchi has often said, we think we are the ones who go to satsang, that we are the ones who search, that we are the ones who find, that we are the ones who do meditation. But when we go in far enough, we see it's not like that at all. That truly speaking, there is no we. There is only one. And he is the only one that does. The one self-same self that Master referred to earlier. And people, we can never, never, never underestimate the power and the effect of grace. That we do see very clearly that we can do nothing. And that, it's like in the bhajan, you are a great sinner. You have committed all kinds of sins. Hail to the power of Almighty Kripal, who carries all the burden. So, it's being done. We are the instruments, maybe, but what is being done by Him. And people, we have nothing to worry about. The core of the universe is love. Okay.
Remember next year, starting January 1st, to email Monique, because as you all know, it was full by the end of January. And I'm sure it'll be full by the end of January next year. So get your name in early for the best spots. Monique tries to do things by first come, first serve. It's a difficult task. She does a great job. Have a wonderful trip home, and I hope to see you all again next year. And I hope the people who are here for the first time come again.